Welcome to today's broadcast of Science Matters. My name is Cynthia Ellick, and I'm your host today on Sun Sounds of Arizona. And today is Sunday, March 16th, 2025. The following articles were originally broadcast on September 1st, 2024. We open with an article from the April 2024 issue of Scientific American. In the Department of Ecology, Last Stand, The Struggle to Save an Untouched American Old Growth Forest, by Alexis Marie Adams. The author lives at the edge of the Greater Yellowstone Ecosystem in Montana and on the southern Peloponnese Peninsula in Greece. Her work has been published by National Geographic, The Guardian, Orion Magazine, and others. She writes, "In Montana's northwestern corner, centuries-old trees rise to a late September sky. Ancient cedar, giant hemlock, shaggy, sharp-needled spruce. Western larch, which can live for 1,000 years, tower above. Early morning's light, filtered through the multi-layered canopies, shimmers green and iridescent as it hits the forest floor, where bright ferns and mushrooms sprout from a carpet of blue lichen and emerald mosses. Mammoth fallen trees are slick with moss, their exposed root balls as big and round as a Volkswagen Beetle. The ground is so sponge-like and moist that it squelches underneath my boots. A breeze moves through the overstory more than 150 feet above, and the forest creaks. A raven calls. A distant woodpecker drums its beak into a tree's thick bark, foraging for beetles and ants. Otherwise, this old-growth primary forest is quiet. Deep in a remote and rugged region known as the Yak, this 192-acre expanse I am walking, unceremoniously called Unit 72 by the U.S. Forest Service, offers a rare glimpse of an original arboreal landscape. This is what the forests that cloak the surrounding mountains and valleys look like before the axe and the chainsaw. For decades, much of the region has been stripped of its timber, yet this lush section of old-growth forest appears to have never been logged, and there is no evidence that it has burned. This stand, and a few others like it remaining in the Yak, is vital habitat for grizzly bears and other threatened and sensitive species, as well as more common wild creatures and plants. Elk, moose, gray wolves, Canada lynx, and the diminutive northern bog lemming, weighing in at a mere ounce, live here. Mayflies rise in clouds from the marshes and streams where otters play. Trumpeter swans soar above. Winters across the Yak are typical of the northern Rockies, bitterly cold with deep snowpack. But in the spring and fall, maritime weather drifts in from the Pacific Northwest, bringing clouds, fog, and drizzle. The convergence of the two weather patterns results in a confluence of flora and fauna. As I step, I see the same tree species that grow along the coasts of Washington State, British Columbia, and southeastern Alaska. I also see the lodgepole and ponderosa pines that thrive in the Rockies. The name Yak is derived from the native Kootenai term for arrow or bow, the same name given to the river that flows through the heart of this region. The USFS, the United States Forest Service, considers the Yak River's watershed, roughly 398,000 acres that touch Idaho to the west and British Columbia to the north, as the Yak region, even though locals say it reaches much farther. Just 3% of the watershed is privately owned. The rest is part of the 2.2 million-acre Kootenai National Forest. Logging began in the Yak in the early 20th century with small-scale family-owned mills. By the 1990s, large corporations had replaced many of the local operations, and they have logged aggressively since then. In some areas, trees are selectively cut and removed, with others allowed to remain. Some tracts are clear-cut, leaving vast swaths of bare ground, desiccated streams and marshes, and countless tree stumps. Thousands of acres of the Yak's old growth and mature trees have been clear-cut in the past 40 years. The USFS, United States Forest Service, manages national forests and grasslands on public lands across the country. The agency, housed under the Department of Agriculture, has long had a reputation for managing forests as crops. In 1986, timber was the highest valued crop in the nation, a USFS report noted. The agency sells areas of forest, sometimes at below market prices, according to various reports, to private logging corporations, sometimes at the expense of valuable ecosystems. The corporations harvest the wood and truck it away for profit. Today, less than half of the Yak's primary forests remain uncut. Yet there is no official designation in place to protect the wild places that still exist. In the Yak, the USFS has proposed or begun five major logging initiatives covering more than 300,000 acres in the Kootenai National Forest. For years, various agencies, experts, and politicians have promoted logging to prevent fire. A thinned forest, they argue, means there is less fuel to burn. The approach has been criticized and fought for just as long. One of the five projects, called Black Ram, was proposed in 2019 for the Yak and blocked in August 2023 by a U.S. District Court judge ruling. Environmentalists say the 95,412-acre project, almost a quarter of the Yak River watershed, would have allowed logging in hundreds of acres of old-growth forest, including Unit 72. The potential loss is deeply unsettling to Rick Bass, my guide through Unit 72. Employed long ago as an oil and gas geologist, Bass is known to some audiences as an exceptional writer of literary fiction and essays, often set in this wild region. Other people know him for his activism in defense of the Yak. Bass, the writer, has published dozens of short stories and more than 30 books. He's won multiple prizes and fellowships, including a Guggenheim Fellowship and a National Endowment for the Arts Literature Fellowship. Bass, the activist, has written editorials and articles about clear-cutting and road-building in the Yak, filed lawsuits against the USFS, and been arrested for civil disobedience multiple times, once in front of the White House. Bass moved to the Yak Valley from Mississippi at age 29 with his then-partner, painter Elizabeth Hughes Bass, as they searched for a place to make their lives and their art. He describes the couple's first season in The Book of Yak, published by Houghton Mifflin in 1996. We traveled through July thunderstorms and August snowstorms, until one day we came over a pass and a valley appeared beneath us, he writes. A blue-green valley hidden beneath heavy clouds, with smoke rising from a couple of chimneys far below, and a lazy river snaking its way through the valley's narrow center, and a power, an immensity, that stopped us in our tracks. Characters in Bass's fiction hunt elk, deer, and grouse. They fish the valley's rivers and streams. They forage for berries and mushrooms. They gather firewood for the long, dark winters. These are not hobbies for his characters. They are imperatives. Drawn to live in this sparsely populated valley, an hour's drive on the easiest of days from the nearest doctor, grocery store, liquor store, or post office, the characters are solitary and self-reliant, yet they are bound together by their shared craving for independence, wilderness, and quiet, their shared love for this place, and their shared fluency in its ways. Off the page, Bass and his neighbors live the same way. Bass's understanding of the land, his deep and intimate relationship with it, is evident as we hike. At 66, he is nimble and lithe as he scampers over the slippery carcasses of fallen trees and ducks under lodgepole pine blowdown, all the while pointing out species of trees and birds and answering my questions about forest policy, the ecological complexity that surrounds us, and the fire resilience of old-growth forests. We stop often, crouching to look at tiny ferns, bright orange mushrooms, and elk scat. Huddled over a fungus that Bass says he's never seen before, we notice a diminutive pygmy slug, a species, he tells me, that is not yet threatened but could be, making its long way over a rotting log. At one point, when Bass is about 10 yards ahead of me, he shouts, "Oh my God! Oh my effing God!" And then, "Come look at this!" As I reach him, he points to an enormous moose shed, a magnificent antler leaning against a downed tree, cast off by a male moose during the winter shedding season. One corner of it has been nibbled by some creature. It's a big one for this country. It's huge. It's one of the most beautiful things I've ever seen, Bass says with enthusiasm and wonder. It's like a holy relic, as poetic a declaration to the yak's wildness as anything. But then he grows quiet and points to the broad trunk of an ancient larch in a grove behind the moose shed. It's been spray-painted with bright orange stripes, indicating that this stand of old-growth forest had been slated to be cut. Bass describes Black Ram as a holdover of the Trump administration. In 2018, then-President Donald Trump mandated increased logging in national forests, ostensibly to reduce wildfire. In 2021, another Trump-era rule went into effect, allowing logging of old-growth stands in six national forests. Last September, Senators Joe Manchin of West Virginia and John Barrasso of Wyoming introduced bipartisan legislation to reduce catastrophic wildfire risk and improve forest health, largely through aggressive cutting. They say they'll log this old-growth forest, this wet, green rain forest, to create fire resilience, Bass says. But these trees are already fire-resistant. This larch, for example, is not only meant to survive fire, it's meant to prosper from it. These attributes, the species diversity here, the structural diversity of the forest, they need to be studied, not clear-cut. But the Forest Service says that by clear-cutting a, what, nearly 1,000-year-old forest, they'll teach it to be resilient. On Earth Day, April 22nd in 2022, President Joe Biden issued Executive Order 14072, mandating an inventory of old-growth and mature forests on federal lands across the U.S. The order's purpose was to create a policy to protect old forests. But even as the USFS and the Bureau of Land Management, or BLM, were tallying the trees, the two agencies continued to plant and implement logging projects, like Black Ram, in mature and old-growth forests across the country. These included nearly 10,000 acres of mature forest in Kentucky's Daniel Boone National Forest, and 54,883 acres of mature and old-growth trees in the Bitterroot National Forest, which extends from Montana across the Idaho border, roughly 250 miles south of the Yaak Valley. Bass says the Forest Service shows no sign of slowing down. It flies in the face of the administration's goal to conserve old-growth forests on public lands, not to mention the administration's climate goals. The vast majority of old-growth forests in the U.S. have been logged, according to Dominic A. Della Sala, chief scientist at Wild Heritage, a project of the Earth Island Institute and former president of the North American section of the Society for Conservation Biology. The untouched areas that remain include California's 2 to 3,000-year-old giant sequoia and coastal redwood forests, northern Wisconsin's 40-acre grove of 300-year-old hemlock and pine, and the scattered remnants of the 250-year-old post-oak groves of the Western Cross Timbers Forest, which once stretched from north-central Texas all the way into southern Kansas. Perils exist worldwide. One of Europe's last old-growth forests spans the border of Belarus and Poland, a remnant of the vast primeval woods that once cloaked the European plain. Most of it is now threatened by logging, despite its also being a World Heritage Site. There have been successes, too. The ancient temperate rainforest of Yakushima, Japan, prized for its cedar trees that are well over 1,000 years old, and its extraordinary biodiversity, has been spared. That Unit 72 ended up in danger is not a surprise to Bass. 27 years ago, he and other residents of the valley founded the Yak Valley Forest Council to protect the region's remaining roadless areas and other critical habitat from road building and clear cutting. When the USFS announced Black Ram, the council's staff, board members, and volunteers rolled up their sleeves yet again and got to work. One of the council's strategies was to prove the region's old forests were indeed old growth and to demonstrate the forest's capacity for carbon storage and fire resilience. The definition of old growth varies and can depend in part on the agency or organization doing the classifying. Most descriptions emphasize the forest's age, its capacity to support exceptional biodiversity, and its structural complexity. The presence of multiple features, such as a multi-layered canopy, a damp, hummocky forest floor, and standing dead trees and downed wood that create moist, fertile habitat for seedlings, fungi, insects, and wildlife. Old growth can overlap with what's called primary forests, woods of any age that have never been subjected to any industrial activities. According to the United Nations Food and Agriculture Organization, since 1990, almost 200 million acres of the world's primary forests have been destroyed, and every year, many more acres of these already rare ecosystems are being lost. De La Sala has studied the biodiversity attributes and climate benefits of mature and old-growth forests around the world. He visited Unit 72 at the Council's request after the USFS proposed the Black Ram project to evaluate whether the unit was indeed old growth. "I can give you all kinds of stats and measurements, but it came down to this," he says. "If it looks like old growth, it smells like old growth, and it feels like old growth. It must be old growth." And Unit 72 sure was. The diversity impressed him. There were big trees, small trees, mid-sized canopy trees. It was the perfect structure for an older forest. The day he went to the stand, De La Sala says, was beautiful, but hotter than hell. "I remember just sweating bullets as we were walking along the road and through the clear cuts. Then we entered the stand, and immediately it was like being in outdoor air conditioning. The cooling effect of that stand, it really caught my attention. Trees were covered with lichens and all kinds of bright mosses, the diversity of plants that I would expect to see in an older forest," he says, "and all that carbon tied up for centuries in the big trees and in the soils. Unit 72 was an easy write-up for me." The USFS approved the Black Ram project in June 2022. The Yak Valley Forest Council sued the federal government in response, partnering with the Center for Biological Diversity and Wild Earth Guardians. In January 2023, the Native Ecosystems Council and the Alliance for the Wild Rockies also filed a joint complaint. The plaintiffs asserted that the USFS violated the National Forest Management Act and the National Environmental Policy Act and did not adequately consider the project's impacts on the region's grizzly bears, a threatened species under the Endangered Species Act. They criticized the USFS for failing to prepare a full environmental impact statement, and they argued that the government didn't consider the impact of the climate of logging the Yak's region's grizzly bears. Seven months later, on August 17, 2023, U.S. District Judge Donald Malloy blocked the agency's approval of Black Ram, largely agreeing with the plaintiff's claims. Every year, temperate forests in the U.S. absorb about 15% of the country's carbon emissions. Old growth and mature forests are particularly effective. As a tree ages, its ability to sequester carbon increases, research has shown. Old-growth stands store 35 to 70% more carbon, including in the soils, than do logged stands. Ultimately, Malloy wrote in his decision, removing carbon from forests in the form of logging, even if the trees are going to grow back, will take decades to centuries to re-sequester. Put more simply, logging causes immediate carbon losses, while re-sequestration happens slowly over time, time the planet may not have. Christine Ackland, Northern Rockies director and senior attorney for the Center for Biological Diversity, says the court ruling is precedent-setting. This is the first time in the context of a timber sale that I'm aware of that a court has said that the Forest Service has to take a hard look at what projects like this actually mean for carbon sequestration, for carbon emissions. Going forward, she notes, for every single logging project, if not across the nation, then at least across Region 1, the agency has to change its methods of analysis to include these questions. Region 1 comprises 25 million acres of public lands that the USFS manages in northern Idaho, Montana, North Dakota, and parts of South Dakota and Washington State. Ackland adds that logging projects that target mature forests, not just old-growth ones, should be evaluated similarly. The way we increase old growth is to protect the trees that are almost there. Other stakeholders in the Kootenai National Forest disagree with the court's ruling, including Julia Altimus, executive director of the Montana Wood Projects Association. To say that old-growth forests are the answer to climate change, that's not quite right, she says. They're part of the solution. They're certainly important. Her group and others argue that trees lose carbon once they hit a certain age. But De La Sala says there is no argument in the scientific community about sequestration. Carbon sequestration, he goes on, reaches a dynamic equilibrium in old-growth stands over time. But it doesn't decline. Individual trees, he says, don't stop accumulating carbon. The larger the tree, the more surface area, the more carbon accumulates. For now, the Black Ram project is stalled, but the USFS could bring it back at any time, Bass says, perhaps by changing the project's plans a bit. Dan Hoddle, press officer for USFS Region 1, says the agency is still evaluating the court's decision and determining next steps. He also says that Unit 72 does not meet the definition of old growth. In the meantime, Bass and the Yaak Valley Forest Council are working with a network of scientists and environmental groups toward a move they hope will offer Unit 72 permanent protection and serve as a model for other old-growth forests around the country and across the world. Their goal is to have the forest designated as the nation's first climate refuge, an area that remains relatively buffered from contemporary climate change over time and enables persistence of valued physical, ecological, and socio-cultural resources. In other words, Bass says, it would be a sanctuary for wildlife and biodiversity and a tool for slowing climate change. The goal is lofty, Bass recognizes, but not unachievable. The Forest Service and the Fish and Wildlife Service haven't been shy about pursuing pilot or experimental projects, he says. The priority should be that the carbon-storing potential of these ancient forests, particularly in the northern latitudes and particularly at Black Ram, be protected with maximum urgency. Moreover, this forest doesn't need our help, Bass says. It's a natural solution for addressing the climate crisis just as it is. It is fire resilient just as it is. Instead of worrying about the world burning, we can help cool it by leaving this forest and others like it just as it is. Leslie Kay, a member of the Kootenai, Yakima, and Nez Perce nations, agrees. It's time to consider the concept of leaving things alone, he says. Let the forest be, without interference, without interruption. Kay grew up on the Flathead Indian Reservation, southeast of the Yaak, and on the Yakima Reservation in Washington State. Today, he develops Kootenai language and culture programming, as well as curricula for youth on the Flatbed Reservation. The Yak, he says, is a part of our ancestral lands, lands that we lost that were taken from us. In times past, he says, my people would go up there by the thousands to the Yak Valley, and they would sing for a couple of nights in a row. For generations, two forms of ceremony took my people there, the summer drumming ceremony that was part of our sun dance, and what you might call, in layman's terms, the vision quest, which helped us understand how to live as a Kootenai person. Our holy lands, you might say, are up there in the Yak, including in Unit 72. Kay says, we want to be able to return to that place and other sacred places to practice our cultural life ways. This is part of the process of reclaiming our identity as Kootenai people, that rejuvenating religious force that is the underpinning of who we are. But if the forest is being logged, how can we return there to practice our ceremonies? This, too, needs to be a part of the conversation. Last October, Bass unveiled a new tool he hopes can help save Unit 72 and old-growth forests everywhere. It was a guitar crafted by a renowned luthier from a length of a spruce tree that fell when the USFS cut a logging road to the edge of Unit 72. The guitar made its debut at the inaugural Climate Aid Concert in Portland, Maine, with a young American singer-songwriter, Maggie Rogers, performing with it. Today, Bass carries the guitar to festivals and concert halls, schools and libraries across the country, where musicians play it, advocating for the future of old-growth forests. At each event, Bass asks, "Can a guitar save a forest?" The morning after I walk Unit 72 with Bass, I begin the 10-hour drive to my home in south-central Montana, following the Yak River to Highway 2. Mist clings to the forests, and the mountains are shrouded in clouds. In Troy, the first town I encounter, wood smoke drifts upward from chimneys, and apples hang heavy from neighborhood trees. I buy a cup of tea for the road, and then I backtrack to the Troy Ranger Station, just north of town, to pick up some maps, including one of the Black Ram Project. The receptionist is warm, friendly, and generous, giving me a poster of pollinators as I leave, after I commented on how beautiful it was. I'm about a mile down the road when I see a moose step out of the thick forest. A logging truck coming the opposite way slows to a stop to let it cross, and so do I. But the moose turns and lopes back into the trees. I think of the Book of Yak and a question that Bass poses in it. Settling into the Yak was not so much work and effort as it was relief, pleasure, and peace. Does such a place exist for everyone? How many places are left in the world? What diversity of them still exists? And for that diversity, what tolerance and what affinity? What is the value of a place? It strikes me that the future of the Yak's old-growth forests, maybe the future of old-growth forests everywhere, might just hang on that question. And this feature article in the Department of Ecology in the April 2024 issue of Scientific American is entitled Last Stand, The Struggle to Save an Untouched American Old-Growth Forest. And now we turn to a short article in News, the Department of Health and Medicine, How to Keep Cats Safe from Bird Flu. Pet owners can take steps to avoid the H5N1 virus. This June 29, 2024 issue of Science News article is written by Tina Hessman-Say. A growing number of cats are getting and dying of bird flu, sparking worries about the risk that the ongoing outbreak poses for feline furballs and their humans. The current U.S. outbreak of highly pathogenic H5N1 virus has been sickening and killing wild birds and poultry since 2021. H5N1 has also jumped into mammals, including farm animals such as goats, dairy cattle, and alpacas. When this happens, if the virus gets a random mutation that helps it replicate better in mammalian cells, the bird flu could adapt to spread easily in people. There's no sign yet that the virus has acquired the changes needed for person-to-person transmission, the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention reported on May 24th of this year. Out of the handful of people who have been infected in the United States, so far, most were in close contact with poultry or cattle, but bird flu showed up in domestic cats. That might give the virus an easier route to infecting people. After all, most people are more likely to encounter and cuddle kitties than chickens or cows. How cats get bird flu? Outdoor cats may contact the virus after catching an infected bird. Whether or not the cats eat the bird, says Megan Davis, a veterinarian and environmental epidemiologist at the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health. The food that people feed their cats could also put the animals at risk to contracting the virus. Davis says, raw meat diets and specifically raw poultry diets have been associated with some outbreaks. The U.S. Department of Agriculture has found viral particles in muscle and other tissue from a culled dairy cow, the agency said on May 24th. None of the meat entered the food supply, but the incident highlights that raw beef might contain the virus. Raw, unpasteurized cow milk has also become an avenue for infection. Raw milk, some of which is labeled for pet use only, could be a way that indoor cats that don't have direct contact with birds could get infected, Davis says. Water or surfaces contaminated with bird droppings also might be potential sources of infection. Some evidence suggests the cats might pass the virus to each other, Davis adds. Bird flu can be deadly for cats. In 2022 and 2023, at least 13 cats in the U.S. got bird flu, and about half died. Some were farm cats that had contact with infected chickens, but some were domestic cats that somehow got sick. So far in 2024, more than 20 cats have contracted H5N1, most of them on dairy farms, the World Organization for Animal Health reports. At least 5 have died. The numbers of infections and deaths are likely higher. For instance, about half of 24 cats that were fed raw milk from infected cattle on one Texas farm earlier this year died, researchers reported in the July issue of Emerging Infectious Diseases. Those cases don't appear to be counted by the World Organization for Animal Health. Symptoms before the Texas cats' deaths included stiff body movements, wobbliness, circling, runny noses, and blindness. Researchers examined 2 of the dead cats and found evidence that the virus had infected their whole bodies. The infection may have killed the cats after reaching the brain. Unfortunately, it's not great news if we get to that point, Davis says. The risk to people seems to be low, however. It's rare but possible for people to catch bird flu from animals, the CDC says, though the exact odds haven't yet been established. Even less clear is whether particularly susceptible people, such as those with weakened immune systems, who live with cats, might have a higher risk of getting infected. Public health agencies stress that the risk of getting bird flu is low for people who aren't exposed to infected birds and their droppings or to other infected animals. Protecting cats and yourself. There are no bird flu vaccines available for cats right now, so keeping felines inside is the best form of protection. For cats that go outside, limit their exposure to bird feces, Davis says. Keep the bird feeders out of the catio. Pet owners can further limit exposure by cleaning their shoes after walking in places where there are bird droppings, disinfecting surfaces where shoes are stored, and keeping shoes away from cats. If your cat brings home a dead bird, don't touch the bird if you can help it. Otherwise, put on a mask, Davis says, gloves and goggles, before disposing of the bird. If you don't have protective gear, a stick in a box will do. Wash your hands after handling the bird. Monitor the cat and let your vet know if it becomes ill. Symptoms tend to appear 2 to 3 days after infection. Finally, don't give cats food that might contain H5N1, especially raw meat or raw milk, Davis says. Not feeding these products to pets is as important as not consuming them yourselves. This article, How to Keep Cats Safe from Bird Flu, appears in the June 29, 2024 issue of Science News. And speaking of birds, this book review from the April 2024 issue of Scientific American, it's entitled Brooding and Cocky, How the Strange Relationship Between Chickens and Humans Shaped Our World. It's a nonfiction book entitled Foul Play, A History of the Chicken from Dinosaur to Dinner Plate by Sally Coulthard, published by Apollo in 2024. As you're reading this or listening to it, there are more than 20 billion chickens alive on the planet. They live absolutely everywhere, except for Antarctica, playing important roles not just in our kitchens, but in our cultures. In this extremely well-researched book, author Sally Coulthard traces the arc of the chicken from its ancestors among the dinosaurs through domestication by humans. Refreshingly, the book Foul Play doesn't repeat false claims from past chicken histories. Instead, it offers stories about the way chickens have shaped the human world, including the strange effects that domestication has had on chickens and humans alike. Chickens invaded our cultures and our language. Brooding men, hot chicks, and cocky youths. These are all part of our vocabulary. Folk magic and religion rely heavily on chickens and their eggs as both physical objects and symbols. Eggs have been viewed as metaphors for rebirth and as a harbinger of doom. One particularly eye-opening section of the book traces the role of chickens in medicine. Not only were chicken eggs integral to vaccine development, they are still used for developing proteins and flu shots, but experiments on chickens, some quite bizarre, led to some of our earlier understanding of blood vessels and organ transplants. For readers hoping to understand how the chicken got to be a species with such global dominance, Foul Play is a welcome addition to the canon. Yet it's focused on what people have done to or taken from chickens, more so than the story of the birds themselves. Of all animals, the author writes, chickens perhaps best represent the strange and often contradictory way we humans treat other species. Occasional mentions of scientific studies on chicken behavior simply present the information. She doesn't go as far to suggest these findings imply that we should treat chickens as more than mere commodities. Coulthard, who is a chicken keeper herself, does recognize the cost of our relationship with chickens from an ethical and environmental standpoint. One section explains why intensive chicken production is a major source of pollution and how widespread use of antibiotics for this production has been linked to the growing problem of antibiotic resistance. In Foul Play, the contradiction in how we treat chickens isn't just an abstract ethical conundrum. It is one with real consequences for our health and the health of our planet. This review of Foul Play, A History of the Chicken from Dinosaur to Dinner Plate, was written by Tove Danovich. Following this short review of A History of the Chicken from Dinosaur to Dinner Plate, we have in brief, first, Silk, A World History by Arathi Prasad, published by William Morrow in 2024. A silk garment is not a single object, but a composite of thousands of individual silkworm cocoons. Likewise, there is no single history of silk. Biologist and writer Arathi Prasad unwinds tangled threads to weave one arc through China, India, Europe, and South America. We learn about dogged early scientists who crossed oceans and amassed massive personal collections to better understand silk's biology and production. Fascinating facts abound. Bombyx mori is just one of a bevy of wild and domesticated silk-producing moths. Sea silk can be isolated from a giant mollusk. Despite her efforts, Prasad readily asserts that many locals who shaped silk and the study remain nameless. They're missing stories, an unmendable hole. This review by Maddie Bender. And The Limits, a novel by Nell Freudenberger, published by Knopf in 2024. When teenager Pia moves back to New York City to live with her father and pregnant stepmother, she struggles with friendships, family tensions, and stifling COVID restrictions. She longs to return to the French Polynesian island of Mo'orea and to Rafi, an island native who assists with her mother's research on deep water coral. Pia's infatuation with Rafi prompts her to join his struggle against the continued exploitation and degradation of the South Pacific, inspiring her to take ever bigger risks to show her devotion. Fiction writer Neil Freudenberger masterfully captures her character's divergent perspectives and complex ties as they encounter extreme circumstances. This review written by Dana Dunham. And back to science news for another book review in the department bookshelf. The review is entitled Climate Change in Dangerous Sports and is written by Darren Incorvalla. The book reviewed is entitled Warming Up by Madeline Orr, published by Bloomsbury Sigma. It's easy to think of sports as an escape from reality, removed from the glaring problems of our world. Researcher Madeline Orr shatters that illusion in the book Warming Up, How Climate Change is Changing Sport. In her debut book, Orr shepherds readers through an at times overwhelming deluge of all the ways climate change is disrupting sports around the world, providing a compelling case for action from athletes, sports leagues, and fans alike. Orr, a sport ecologist at the University of Toronto, draws on her academic expertise to outline how climate change is upending sports, be it wildfires almost destroying a high school football program or rising seas subsuming coastal golf courses. While Orr bolsters her argument with data and interviews with experts, it's the personal stories that are most powerful. There's the heartbreaking story of University of Maryland college football player Jordan McNair, who died of heat stroke suffered at practice. Or an avid skier shares her beef with global warming literally melting away winter sports around the world and the local economies they sustain. In the introduction, Orr says that the order of the chapters is irrelevant, but the chapters do follow a loose organization, and grouping them into sections would have made the overall trajectory of the book easier to follow. The first 11 of the book's 17 chapters mainly focus on how warming temperatures, rising seas, increasing wildfires, and other consequences of climate change are already impacting the industry and will worsen in the future. For instance, outdoor pond hockey, a crucial part of Canada's culture and the launch pad of many of ice hockey's greats, is at risk of disappearing altogether as winters become warmer and ice becomes rarer. It's refreshing to see Orr explicitly talk about how climate change is disproportionately impacting nations that are least responsible for global greenhouse gas emissions, a point that can get lost in Western reporting on the topic. High temperatures are threatening Kenyan runners. Rising seas are eroding a famous rugby beach in Fiji. A 2022 flood devastated Pakistan's sports leagues, along with much of the country. But against the backdrop of climate change's harrowing reality, Orr keeps hope alive in the last six chapters. The sports world can adapt to climate change to reduce its own culpability and to ensure that imperiled sports survive. She spotlights the past and present activism of athletes who are fighting for sustainability. One heartening example is Innes Fitzgerald, a teenage cross-country runner who refused to fly from Britain to Australia for the 2023 World Athletics Championships out of concern for air travel's carbon emissions. Before Fitzgerald, no athlete had actually passed up championship opportunities because of a moral quandary with flying, or notes. Like climate activism in so many other sectors of society, it seems changes in sports will be spearheaded by the youth. Orr's writing is authoritative and conversational, and while she sometimes slips into academic jargon, her language is largely accessible even to readers with no scientific background. The book is jam-packed with information and has something for sports fanatics and casual fans alike. In the fight against climate change, the book Warming Up shows us that it's time for the sports world to play ball. And this review, Climate Change Endangers Sports, appears in the June 29th, 2024 issue of Science News. And back to Science News for another book review in the department bookshelf. The title of the review is Sacrificing Wildlife in the Name of Conservation. The book reviewed is Cull of the Wild, written by Hugh Warwick, published by Bloomsbury Wildlife. In the late 1860s, European colonists started importing hedgehogs into New Zealand. The goal, to make the unfamiliar landscape feel a bit more like home. Over the next 100 years, hedgehogs settled in most of New Zealand's available habitat and developed a taste for native bird eggs, lizards, and invertebrates. Now, the hedgehogs are among the millions of animals killed worldwide each year in culls intended to protect vulnerable species and habitats. Some say culling is essential to conservation. Others say it robs animals of their right to live. But for ecologist Hugh Warwick, the nuances of culling further complicate the already complex nature of conservation. In his latest book, Cull of the Wild, Warwick attempts to mediate between the wide-ranging approaches to culling. Part travel memoir, part philosophical treatise, Cull of the Wild is an honest, surprisingly tame read that asks hard questions of its sources, author, and audience. The essence of science is not that it knows everything, but that it continually challenges everything, Warwick writes. It is not just what we think, but how we think that needs challenging. Warwick opens the book ready to do just that, laying out his prejudices as an ecologist, hedgehog expert, and someone who is vaguely vegan. Although a bit winding, the resulting 300-page quest finds the author readily challenging these biases. Whether he's interviewing a gamekeeper or diving into animal ethics, Warwick eagerly searches for middle ground in the ongoing battle that is wildlife management. The ecologist recruits an eclectic crew to highlight this middle ground. There's Mike Swan, senior advisor to the Game and Wildlife Conservation Trust, who takes Warwick on a tour of the estate he manages for game bird shoots in Dorset, England. Swan culls foxes and crows to boost pheasant and partridge numbers for hunters. While Warwick is not a fan of hunting or culling, he recognizes Swan's passion for nature, mind for conservation, and desire to find humane ways to keep bird predators in check. Warwick also interviews Monica Engel, a conservationist from Brazil who earns a seal hunting license to better understand Canadian seal hunters and, in turn, natural resource management. When I am not there listening, I find it is so sad that the hunters and the animal rights activists enter into this debate with often so much hate, Engel tells Warwick. It drowns out moderate voices. It stops progress. These sources and their views make for the book's most interesting parts. In one chapter, Warwick meets Tony Martin of the Wildlife Recovery Trust in East Anglia, England. Martin tracks American mink, imported into the British Isles in 1929 for the prized fur. Mink from fur farms soon started popping up in the British countryside. Mink now prey on multiple riverside species, including the water vole, a rat-sized rodent already declining due to habitat loss. Using an armada of 800 floating traps, Martin's team works to save the native species by culling this elusive predator. These mink rafts are live traps. The mink are later euthanized with an air pistol. Though gruesome, Martin's approach has hints of compassion. He refuses to cull mink on England's islands for fear that they'd starve to death in traps before anyone could collect them. He co-authored a 2020 paper outlining essential questions that ensure exterminations aren't needlessly drawn out or doomed to fail. "I don't enjoy killing animals," says Martin, whose father ran a mink farm. "And if there was another way to restore our riparian ecosystems without killing mink, then I would be all for it. But until then, it is important that we do it as humanely as possible. While much of the book focuses on species found in Warwick's native United Kingdom, his pondering takes readers from a fenced-in preserve in New Zealand to the mouse-infested bird colonies of Gough Island in the South Atlantic. Warwick also touches on famous characters in the invasive species saga: Australia's toxic cane toads, Burmese python escapees in the Florida Everglades, the cocaine hippos of Colombian drug trafficker Pablo Escobar. In many cases, eradication is either unfeasible or met with public opposition. Though culling is about invasive and native troublemakers, much of Cull of the Wild concerns itself with human exceptionalism. Dubbing us Homo Oxizer, or Man the Killer, Warwick likens humankind to a fox in the chicken coop, instinctively driving the livable planet towards destruction. Warwick reminds us that we often play judge, jury, and executioner, or at least supporters of those that are, when dealing with introduced species or damaged ecosystems. But to play God in the 21st century, Warwick warns, requires us to examine our prejudices about animal suffering and our motivations behind culling. In its simplest form, this is head versus heart territory. And this review of Cull of the Wild was written by Aaron Tremper. And finally, a New York Times trilobite. Posted on June 25, 2024, and written by Monique Brouillette, this trilobite is entitled "Scientists Find First Evidence That Butterflies Crossed an Ocean." Researchers discovered painted ladies on a South American beach and then built a case that they started their journey in Europe or Africa. Early one morning in late October 2013, Gerard Talavera, an entomologist, saw something highly unusual, a flock of painted lady butterflies stranded on a beach in French Guiana. The painted lady, or the species Vanessa cardui, is one of the world's most widespread butterflies, but it isn't found in South America. Yet there they were, lying in the sand of the continent's eastern shores, their wings tattered and riddled with holes. Judging by their condition, the bleary-eyed Dr. Talavera, who works at the Institut Botanique de Barcelona in Spain, guessed that they were recovering from a long flight. The insect is a champion of long-distance travel, routinely crisscrossing the Sahara on a trek from Europe to sub-Saharan Africa, covering up to 9,000 miles. Could they also have made the 2,600-mile journey across the Atlantic Ocean without any place to stop and refuel? Dr. Talavera wanted to find out. Following the long-range movements of insects is challenging. Tools like radio tracking devices are too large for insects' small and delicate frames, and radar allows for monitoring only of specific locations. Scientists have had to rely on educated guesses and citizen science observations to piece together travel patterns. We see butterflies that appear and disappear, but we are not proving the links directly. We are just making assumptions, Dr. Talavera said. In 2018, he developed a way to use a common genetic sequencing tool to analyze pollen DNA. Pollen grains stick to pollinating insects like butterflies when they are feeding on nectar from flowers. Dr. Talavera used a method called DNA metabarcoding to sequence the pollen's DNA and determine which plant they came from. Later, the DNA could be traced to geographical flora to chart the insect's path. In a paper published a few weeks ago in the journal Nature Communications, Dr. Talavera and his team describe a crucial clue to cracking the mystery of the stranded butterflies. Pollen clinging to the butterflies in French Guiana matched flowering shrubs in West African countries. These shrubs bloom from August to November, which matches the timeline of the butterfly's arrival. That suggested the butterflies had crossed the Atlantic. The idea was tantalizing, but Dr. Talavera and his team were careful not to jump to conclusions. In addition to studying the pollen, The researchers sequenced the butterflies' genomes to trace their lineage and found that they had European-African roots. This ruled out the possibility that they had flown over land from North America. Then they used an insect tracking tool called isotope tracing to confirm that the butterflies' natal origins were in Western Europe, North Africa, and West Africa. By adding weather data showing favorable winds blowing from Africa to America, they were building up to a monumental finding. "This is a brilliant piece of biological detective work," said David Lohman, an evolutionary ecologist at the City College of New York, who was not involved in the work. Dr. Talavera's forensic detective-like tracing supported the conclusion that the painted lady butterflies made the first transoceanic journey ever recorded by an insect. It's likely they were on their typical route through Africa when they were swept off course by a strong wind. Once over the ocean, the butterflies kept flying until they reached the shore. Insect migrations are the largest movement of biomass around the world. Over southern England alone, a staggering 3.5 trillion insects migrate annually. Their ability to transport pollen, fungi, and even plant diseases across vast distances highlights the global impact of these tiny critters. With the Painted Lady's oceanic migration, experts say, scientists may have a better way of tracking these journeys. The findings showed that the delicate creatures could endure a difficult and dangerous journey, which most likely lasted between 5 and 8 days. It also demonstrates how much scientists still have to learn. Jessica Ware, an evolutionary biologist at the American Museum of Natural History, who was not involved in the study, called the study's methods innovative, adding that it will help us understand migrations. And that brings us to the end of today's broadcast of Science Matters. My name is Cynthia Ellick, and I've been your host today on Sun Sounds of Arizona. And remember, if you missed any part of this program, you can access it on demand at sunsounds.org and click Broadcast Info and Audio. Thank you so much for listening, and please join me again next Sunday. Have a great week.